I also want to thank Jeff, who brought all the fabulous food and does that for us quite a lot. And to thank all my board members here who really show up all the time, which is more than anybody could ask for. Paul for coming to speak tonight, Rhonda, Copeland, Mimi Abramovitz, or the ones able to make it tonight. And we thank you for always being present. So what we're going to be doing tonight, besides ignoring the cars, is we're doing this particular dialogue a little differently because people might say times are changing. And it means that we have to sort of think a little bit about how we shift or shape our work going forward. So I'll be making a couple of comments on what I see as the context that we're in now, in specifically in relationship to our work. And then we'll give each of our program directors an opportunity to talk about how their particular programs might evolve in this new environment. And then you'll get to hear from Paul, who's going to wrap it all up for us and give us that deep and broad analysis that we're always looking to him to hear about.
No pressure.
No pressure, none. It's just going to be, you know, transformative, right? You tie it all together, it'll be transformative. So this is our sixth human rights dialogue, and we're entering our fifth year of work. And that by itself is almost remarkable. I say it's remarkable because when we founded 4 years ago, there was one foundation that supported this work. We started it with what you might call a prayer and a dime, and not much else, not knowing where it was going to go. It was an environment when we thought that there were issues emerging that we thought were past. You know, all of a sudden we're in an environment where torture and indefinite detention and rendition was now up for grabs and up for debate. So it was very challenging to keep economic and social rights on the agenda in that environment. Although I think the present moment really shows us why it was important to do so. And despite the soundness of the approach, and despite the siren, and despite the fact that it's actually a very practical way to organize ourselves, we were also faced with the problem that the concept hadn't even really fully come into its own in terms of being legitimate. Even within the human rights community, the legitimacy of the concept was pretty much constantly under attack. These rights aren't real rights, these rights are aspirational, these rights are impractical. And that's the environment that we started working in. You add to that that it was one of the most politically repressive eras that our country has gone through under the Bush administration. And, you know, you've got to modify your expectations in terms of how much progress you make. But we paired up and we partnered and supported communities that were very much facing the brunt or were bearing the brunt of that repressive political environment. And we surprised ourselves with the progress we were able to make in that context. So we paired up with parents and youth in schools facing what is often called zero tolerance policies. Now, that seems like an abstract concept, but what it means is kids being slammed up against the wall by cops, maced in hallways, suspended for a comment or a look. We literally interviewed students that were suspended because they gave a look that they weren't supposed to give. Abusive environments where teachers, even teachers, degrade students, and altogether a culture that kids were being pushed out of school in such large numbers that in many schools not even half graduated, you know, and were basically losing generation after generation. It's a hostile environment for the poor because none of these schools serve children that weren't poor. Yet we paired up with parents in LA and in New York, and not that long afterwards, Los Angeles Unified School District, one of the biggest in the country, passed what they call a positive behavior support policy. Now, you say, well, what is that? That is one of the main alternatives being promoted to zero tolerance. And that is one of the biggest challenges to zero tolerance. It's an entirely different approach to managing conflict, discipline issues in overcrowded and under-resourced schools. And that got our foot in the door to create a trend to reverse something that I've never been able to understand, not tolerating children. We also worked with farm workers in Florida who worked in an environment so degraded so unregulated that there have been 7 criminal prosecutions in the last 15 years for slavery and forced labor in the state of Florida. And over 1,000 people have been freed, with criminal penalties being imposed from 5 to 30 years. This has been happening under the radar screen. You would think this would be front page news all over the country, but it isn't. Yet those farm workers, since 2004, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, have reached 4 major agreements with corporations that double wages of workers and create a participatory monitoring system for these abuses and impose a code of conduct. And we're this close, we really genuinely are this close to breaking the will of growers who haven't allowed these agreements to be implemented. The agreements are coming faster and faster, and they've done this in one of the worst political environments you can imagine. Similarly, after Hurricane Katrina hit, we started working with communities that were first abandoned, then criminalized, and then watched their homes being destroyed. We're working with public housing residents, where despite the fact that the public housing communities were not really hurt by the hurricane, they brought in bulldozers and destroyed thousands of units, taking advantage of what, you know, Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. And what in those communities, after everything they had been through, had to watch any chance of their homes being reconstructed, their lives being rebuilt, sort of bulldozed away in front of them. And those partners have been working against extraordinary odds. And we also started working more recently in a white rural state, which is an unusual partnership for us because it's often really communities of color, marginalized communities that we work with. But we've formed a partnership in Montana with a very different kind of constituency, which kind of shows an openness to this approach among new sectors. And despite that hostile environment, we made progress. We made quite a lot of progress. Now somebody moved my pages. Hold on. And now we feel like we have a model. And we also have new opportunities, because I think it's pretty clear that things are changing. It's pretty clear that the next administration is not going to be putting torture, indefinite detention, and rendition at the center of their policy agenda. That leaves more space to really move these issues and develop them. It enables us to do more. We're also facing an economic crisis that's causing people to really rethink the role of the government and really move the public debate to recognizing government responsibility for well-being of sort of everyone in society. And there's growing criticism of the extreme income inequality in this country, speculation, and just plain greed. There's growing criticism of that culture being acceptable. So these are new opportunities. But with opportunities, obviously come problems too, right? They come hand in glove. So sometimes I call them propertunities. I've been running around the office going, what are we going to do with these propertunities? These propertunities pose interesting new challenges. So the opportunity piece of the equation is that we now have some space, right, at the national level. We have something we can work with, and we think there's going to be a good interplay, right? We think we can bring the local to the national. We think we can create a vehicle for the communities to have voice in this national debate. And we have openings for actual change, most likely. You know, nothing certain, but most likely. The country's really fed up. The problem part of the equation is that we have to make sure we don't move away from our local work, right? That we don't drain the support to social movements, because unless we keep supporting them, unless we keep building capacity on the ground, whatever we achieve won't outlast the administration. It won't be sustainable. That's something we've seen time and time again. So the problem or the challenge is figuring out with our, you know, as everyone faces limited resources, how to balance those two things. But human rights, I think, offer us more opportunities than problems here. So the propertunity side of the equation, I think, weighs in our favor. And that's because one thing that's sort of been really shown to be missing is something that tells us what the goalposts are, something that tells us what the end game should be. Since the financial crisis, I've taken to starting some of my presentations by saying, you know, our healthcare system, our housing market, it's in just as good shape as our financial system. They're all just in the same sound, healthy shape. And in many ways for the same reasons. Like, it was widely accepted and assumed that a financial sector was purely for ensuring profit for those who could play the market the best. rather than a financial sector being organized and designed to ensure the well-being of the entire society, whether or not an individual can play in the market. And you could see that problem, that sort of where the goalposts are, in almost every sector. It is ridiculous that we have to start out some of our human rights to healthcare assessment by saying the goal of a healthcare system is to protect health. You would think. You wouldn't have to say that. And in the case of healthcare, you know, I could say with very comfortably that the only goal of a health sector should be to protect health. And yet that's not how we design it. Clearly the insurance sector actually has to minimize care to maximize profit. They're incentivized to let people be sick. You could look at our housing market. It's fine if a family buys a house and builds equity, has a home over years. But houses are not gambling chips that should be, you know, flipped over as fast as possible in a speculation market, because that doesn't build homes, that doesn't build stability, that doesn't build community. And the way our housing sector had recently been deregulated and reorganized, it wasn't for the purpose of creating stable home and equity for families. It was really another vehicle to feed speculation and greed. And similarly, in education, although it is seen as a public good, the goalposts are wrong. Right now, our education system is there to sort kids by class and race, predetermining what their potential is, and deciding by the time they're 5 years old whether they're going to prison or Princeton. You know, pretty much, you can predict, in at least in significant proportions, where kids are going to end up. So human rights standards demand that we look at this differently. And we're not doing that yet. We have a better landscape, but we're still not doing that. People, you know, are mumbling and talking about it's time for the New Deal. Well, we need tools, we need arguments, we need analysis to push us to take much bolder action, to question even more deeply our structural arrangements. And we genuinely believe that if we enable and empower communities to use this tool, this is one way they can do it. So what I'm going to do now is hand it over to our program directors. That's how we see where we are. We're still committed to the local. We want to create an interplay with the national, but through social movements. And we really want to see if we can shift the goalposts in the conversation. And you'll hear from our education director on a 19-state coalition, about a 19-state coalition that she has built to make zero tolerance a thing of the past for children. Maybe they can tolerate them somewhat. You'll hear from our healthcare director how she's been pushing the needle, as they say, to get advocates to think about actually being faithful to healthcare principles in terms of what we call for and push for, or human rights to healthcare principles. And you'll hear about from our housing directors how she wants to make public housing a national conversation, something that has not happened in many years. So I'll turn it over, and I thank you for being willing to listen. And is Liz.
Thanks, Kat. So my name is Liz Sullivan. I'm the Human Rights Education Program Director at NESRI. And the education program works with parent, youth, and teacher groups in cities all over the country, in New York, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Chicago, to fight what we really see as a human rights crisis in our public schools, where young people are being pushed out of schools and into the prison system because they're being denied their right to high-quality education and to be treated with dignity in learning environments. Children of color and children from poor communities in particular are in under-resourced and overcrowded schools where they're not given the support and guidance they need to learn. Teachers are also denied the resources they need in schools and struggle to create positive learning environments and to engage their students because of a focus on high-stakes testing, because of a lack of support services from guidance counselors and other people in school. And instead of addressing these underlying disparities between school systems, our government imposes harsh zero-tolerance discipline policies on schools. It started with the 1994 Gun-Free Schools Act at the federal level, where schools were required to impose harsh penalties for having a weapon in school or serious acts of violence. And as it multiplied across the country, states and school districts started implementing these same harsh punishments, suspensions, expulsions for minor disciplinary infractions, sort of a get tough on kids approach, the same kind of approach that you see in New York City taken with policing in communities and CompStat. The same thing's going on in our schools. You have kids getting suspended for, you know, 6 to 10 days for talking back to teachers, for minor arguments in the hallway. You have school safety agents and police officers who are patrolling hallways instead of school aides, or principals, and handcuffing and arresting kids for getting into arguments, for pushing one another, for horseplay in the hallways. I was in a room a couple months ago with a bunch of New York City school teachers, and they were talking about the challenges that they face in their classroom. And one of the teachers became really visibly upset, talking about, why are we putting money into metal detectors and school safety agents instead of small class sizes, guidance counselors, and really quality, engaging curricula that will get kids interested in school again? When you don't have any art, when you don't have after-school programs, when you don't have clubs for kids to get involved in, of course they're going to act out. Of course they're going to be, you know, frustrated in school. And, you know, this reflects a broader problem with our society and our government institutions and education and other areas where we react to problems instead of taking responsibility for ensuring the fundamental human rights of all people. So NESRI is working with our community partners to promote a proactive, positive human rights framework as an alternative to this punitive, reactive approach in schools. Human rights obligates our government and by extension our school systems to provide an education that is holistic, that ensures the full academic, social, and emotional development of children, that creates environments that protect the dignity of children, and that involve parents, teachers, students, and our communities in developing policies in schools to ensure that our schools are held accountable to the people who they serve. To help build this movement, NESRI works mostly at the local level with parent and community groups to change school district policies and state policies. But the federal government also has a role to play in education through the incentives it creates and through its impact on the national dialogue and the culture around education in this country. And the new administration coming up hopefully will create a really great opportunity to shift away from these punitive towards positive policies. We've been working with a coalition of 19 groups that we helped, oh, sorry, 40 groups from 19 states around the country that we helped to found 2 years ago now and has grown enormously to promote federal alternatives to zero tolerance that explicitly meet 4 human rights standards: to the full development of the child, dignity of the child, participation of parents and students, and non-discrimination and equity. And we're working right now with the Children's Defense Fund, a national grassroots coalition called Education Not Incarceration, and other groups around the country to come up with a federal white paper that we'll be presenting next year to talk about policy options for what the government can do to take action to promote these positive alternatives. And right now, there's a bill in Congress that was introduced by Senator Obama as well as some other representatives from Illinois that would allow schools to use funding for positive behavior support, which is the positive model that we work to get passed in Los Angeles. So there's support for these issues brewing, but there still is a lot of work to do to change this sort of approach that we have to kids and see them not as problem students who we need to remove from schools and deal with, but all children is, you know, in need of nurturing and care, and that everyone can reach their full potential if our schools meet their fundamental human rights. So, thank you.
I'm
Rudiger, the Human Rights Health Program Director. And I have the pleasure to refer back to the second presidential debate when one of the candidates said that healthcare is a right. And that was clearly very exciting for us. And I'm sure it's no news for you that that was Senator Obama. And I was particularly excited that the question got asked. And I thought that, as well as the answer, really kicked us off to a new level of discourse and hopefully will help us shift the debate. And I'd like to take some credit for that. Well, maybe I should be a bit more modest. Well, it's also interesting to pay attention to what exactly was said. He did say healthcare should be a right, and not that healthcare is a right. Now, both statements are correct in the sense that we all, as human beings, have the human right to health and healthcare. So that right is not granted by law or by governments. We have that by virtue of being human. But at the same time, in the US, it's not protected and certainly not fulfilled. So in that sense, we don't have it yet here, even though as human beings, we're entitled to it. Now, this is where our program comes in. And we want to shift the debate from healthcare as a commodity to healthcare as a human right. But we want to do a lot more. We want to move beyond rhetorical statements, and we want to really change the healthcare system and have a healthcare system that is based on human rights, the financing based on human rights, and the delivery based on human rights principles. So that means when a candidate says it's a right, that for us is not the end point, that's the starting point of our work. So we've prepared long before Senator Obama went sort of on the national, changed the national discourse in that sense, or hopefully will change the discourse. We did an assessment of the presidential candidates according to human rights standards and principles that we developed. And the aim is to give a deeper but also more practical meaning to what a right to healthcare actually means by comparing the presidential candidates' proposals. And you will find that in your packet that's on your chairs. We found actually that neither of the candidates meets human rights standards. And that was mainly because they both rely on market competition without attempting to incentivize markets in a way that, as Kathy said, they really only serve to protect our health rather than to protect their own profits. And neither candidate has really found a solution to that because, frankly, they didn't look at it from that point of view. So they still looked at the healthcare as a market commodity. And you can read the entire assessment if you're interested in your packet, but I just in summary, when I say they fail to meet human rights standards, I do have to add that one of the candidates was clearly a lot better in moving towards meeting them than the other candidate, and again, there's no points for guessing who that might be. Nevertheless, we don't think it's enough. One candidate might create more, might create the circumstances so that more people can buy coverage, and the other candidate may make it so that actually less people will be able to access health insurance and health care. But that's just not enough for us. So what we're advocating is not a particular healthcare system, but the human right to health standards that we developed they're a lot more flexible than that. So the main goal is to have a system of health protection in place, and those standards help to guide us towards that goal. Now, what that creates for the human right to health program and advocating at a national level is really an opening to come into the debate, to talk to a whole range of different national healthcare advocacy coalitions, and not to talk just to, say, the single payer folks. But we're able to engage with all these coalitions, and indeed we've done so, and I think we have succeeded in bridging some of those gaps and talking to people who otherwise would not talk to, say, single payer folks. But we can come to them and say, well, these are standards. Look, if you say we need quality, we need affordable healthcare, well, what the human rights standard says is that then, for example, this needs to be true for everybody. And so there's a conversation we have opened up, I think, and we've got a number of national healthcare coalitions to adopt human rights language and some of the key principles, including a national faith-based coalition and the National Women's Coalition. Now, with regard to the new administration, we do have sort of specific steps in mind that they could take to move a little bit further towards the human rights principles and standards. And I want to explain to you very briefly the three key steps that we think they need to take. And that includes, firstly, to make a comprehensive public health plan available to everybody who lives in the United States, and not to exclude anyone on the grounds of income or on the grounds of immigration status. And that is what currently most reform proposals, even by healthcare advocacy organizations, still do. They're very exclusive, and we're fighting that exclusion because we think that we know that as a society, we have the collective responsibility, and indeed the government has the obligation, that all of us can access healthcare as a public good and not just some of us. And that is really the key principle of universality. And secondly, reforms need to move towards an equitable system of financing healthcare, with people contributing according to their ability to pay and not according to the health services they actually use. And that's obviously part of the principle of equity. And then thirdly, a new administration and indeed all the healthcare advocacy groups, they really need to move beyond this focus on health insurance and need to move to a direct access to healthcare approach. So it's the shift from coverage to care that we'd like to see. And at a minimum and at a first step, what this needs to include is better regulation of the private insurance sector so that they can no longer deny us access to care. And that would meet the principles of accountability and non-discrimination under the human rights framework. So we really need to push candidates and the new administration and other healthcare advocates to secure these human rights principles. So how do we do this? As Kathy and Liz have already outlined, Nesri believes that change comes from the ground up. And it's not so much the conversations that are outlined that we have with national healthcare coalitions that will result in lasting change, but it is really working with local and state-based activists and enabling them to integrate human rights principles into their advocacy campaigns. So it's really the most important aspect of the program is to work with is our work with grassroots activists and building a more broad-based movement for the right to healthcare that starts at a local and state-based level. And I, for example, I've worked with organizations in Vermont and in Pennsylvania and Washington State and in Hawaii. And currently our most sort of fruitful partnership is in the state of Montana, as Kathy mentioned. And our work there is quite broad, and it ranges from various sort of local activities. We're giving advice to a local board of health that is seeking to implement a universal healthcare zone in their county, to a much broader effort of making healthcare a constitutional right in the state of Montana, which is obviously a multi-year campaign to completely shift the discourse and at the end of the day, the legal framework for the right to health in Montana. So I believe that it is these grassroots actions from activists that will sooner or later get the attention of the new administration and will deepen the commitment to the right to health care and will give it some meaning in this country.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Tiffany Gardner, and I'm the director of the Human Right to Housing Program at Nesri. And I'm going to talk a bit about the housing program's agenda for the next and new administration. So there's a social commitment, at least in theory, to guaranteeing our nation's children quality education. And there's growing consensus that the government should provide, or at least ensure, health care for all of its citizens. Yet public commitment to affordable and decent housing remains dangerously low. So one of the overarching goals of the housing program is to begin to build this concept of a human right to housing within the United States. There really is a silent tragedy taking place across the United States, and particularly in poor communities. Rental housing costs are increasing while wages are either remaining stagnant or more typically decreasing. In fact, 15 million Americans are paying more than half their income on housing costs, and 3.5 million Americans are experiencing homelessness in any given year. And the levels of homeless families, which include children, are rising year after year. In that backdrop, you have many, and particularly those in poor communities, who are having to choose between paying their housing cost, which is generally rental cost, or purchasing life essentials, such as food and medicine. And in the United States, this ought not to be so. Many of the detriments that poor communities are facing with respect to their housing are the direct result of government's retreat from its historic obligation and commitment to providing housing options to our nation's poor and vulnerable communities. For instance, HOPE 6, which stands for Housing Opportunities for People Everywhere, is a government program that was started, enacted in 1988, with the stated objective of bettering the housing conditions of our public housing residents and communities. But in reality, since 1998, there have been over 63,000 demolitions of public housing communities across the country, and cities have not replaced nearly that amount of units. This has resulted in wholesale displacement and dispersal of poor communities and families with increasing homelessness and other vulnerabilities. In addition to the threat of having their communities destroyed, residents of public housing, as well as Section 8 voucher holders, also face possible eviction for the tiniest of infractions. Under what I call draconian one-strike policies, for instance, a public housing or Section 8 resident can be evicted for talking mean, talking nasty to a housing authority employee. In fact, one of our allies in New Orleans, Kawana Jasper, who is a Section 8 voucher holder and has been one of the community leaders to fight the demolitions of public housing in New Orleans, she was recently served eviction notices for, quote, using abusive language towards a Hano employee. And of course, I thought she was lying, I gotta be honest. I said, this is ridiculous. There's no way in the world they were going to evict you for this. And in fact, I spoke to her lawyer at the legal aid services in New Orleans and said, why is she being evicted? What are the grounds? And the lawyer said, oh, using abusive language. And basically what this means is that Kawana had an interview, an appointment with her social worker at the Housing Authority office, and she got frustrated, as we most do, and got into a back and forth with the guard there. And he kicked her out, and as a result, she cursed at him. And as a result, a couple of days later, she got eviction notice papers. Kawana is now on probation. She had to apologize to the officer. She had to write a statement that went into the court record that she was sorry for using this abusive language, that she wouldn't do it again. As a community activist, she was involved with a lot of demonstrations in New Orleans, but now that she's on probation, if she's arrested, there's a very real threat that they would take her voucher away. Therefore, it has really quelled her activism. And believe it or not, she's one of the lucky ones. And we were told as much. So these type of policies, particularly these residency requirements, are being used across the nation to purge these roles, these public housing roles, these Section 8 voucher roles of vulnerable communities. And in particular in a place like New Orleans, and we know what's going on down there, they're being used to really purge the city of poor communities. First they demolished the public housing, and now they're cracking down with these residency requirements to get rid of those same residents who were in public housing who now have Section 8 vouchers. So basically what we're really seeing is a national crisis taking place in cities across our communities, and I really call them, really it's a silent crisis, and it's a silent population, and it's really about class, and it's about poor people, and it's about how we're treating the most vulnerable in our society. So from demolished communities to lack of dignity and respect, these policies really do violate the human right to housing of these communities, and they must change. So in the next administration, the housing program here at NESRI, we have two main goals. One is, as I said, to bring greater national attention to the crisis, the housing crisis affecting poor Americans. And really this crisis is part and parcel with what we're currently seeing in the economic industry and in the economic realm of our country, the fallout. And secondly, it's really to increase this recognition within the United States of the human right to housing and what that means and what those obligations are. So to come closer to achieving these goals, the housing program has several initiatives and three in particular that I want to discuss tonight. So we've been working with Representative Maxine Waters' office down in D.C., and she is the chair of the Subcommittee on Housing and Community Affairs. And we're working with her to try to get joint congressional hearings on the crisis in public and affordable housing. And she has really been a steward with respect to housing rights and housing for the poor. In October, she and Barney Frank, who is the chair of the Appropriations Committee, sent a letter to HUD saying, you have to stop the demolition of public housing communities. It has reached crisis proportions. Homes are not being rebuilt. People are going into homelessness, and this must stop. So she has really been a steward and a supporter of ours. And what we're hoping to do with the hearings are really, really several things, and I'll just highlight the most important ones. A, as I said, it's really increased national attention, and I can't really drive this point home enough because it's not being talked about. In all of the presidential debates, no one's talking about the housing needs of our poor communities. Even with this bailout, I was just talking earlier tonight with Paul and with others about, as we speak about the bailout, it's sort of like all we have in this country are the upper class and the middle class. We have no poor Americans. And even Obama, and although a lot of his policies are more progressive than McCain's, even in his speeches he says, with the bailout, we need to make sure some of this money comes back to taxpayers, middle class taxpayers. But again, the issue of poor Americans is silent. So I can't stress that enough, increasing the visibility of this population. Second, we hope that the hearings will really assist in the passage of positive and progressive housing legislation that's out there. There are congressional members down in D.C. that have different pieces of legislation in bill form that talk about the amendment of these one-strike policies that speak to greater participation on the part of residents of public housing in Section 8, and also talk about greater oversight of HUD and a lot of the mismanagement that has occurred. And then third and finally, we're hoping that through the hearings we can institute a moratorium on the demolitions, at least until there is a guarantee of one-for-one replacement. The second initiative that we have going is that we've been working with housing rights groups and resident groups across the country, assisting them in their individual campaigns. In particular, what we've been trying to do is to develop human rights approaches to local housing law and policy. So, for instance, we have partnered with May Day New Orleans, which is a resident group in New Orleans, and we have been assisting them with their anti-one-strike campaign. And then third and finally, we've been working with the United Nations, and believe it or not, the United Nations is very, very, very interested in what's happening with housing opportunities and the housing crisis for poor America. So I, in particular, have been working with the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, as well as the UN Advisory Group on Forced Evictions, and they are scheduled to make formal visits to the United States after the elections in February. And NESI will be coordinating these visits, and a part of the visits will be my organizing them to go to certain cities where HUD's policies have been particularly disastrous, as well as have meetings with congressional members in Washington, D.C., those working on housing policy. And what I really want to do, if you can indulge me, is just really point out Dr. Derek Norvell, who is the founder of Concerned Citizens of Greater Harlem. And he really did start this initiative to get the congressional hearings going. This is something he's been working on for 2 years. He's a resident of public housing in Harlem. He understood the need, not just for hearings here in New York City, but nationally. And through his efforts, through my joining his efforts, we have been able really to build a national coalition with resident organizations in Chicago, Minneapolis, Atlanta, LA, New Orleans, New York, and the list just keeps growing of folks saying we need to have these hearings. So with that being said, what we're hoping and what I'm hoping through the housing program is that with this staggering, unprecedented economic fallout, we're hoping that we have a window, an opportunity, as Kathy said, to really push forward progressive legislation, progressive policy, not just in housing in my program area, but really in all of our program areas. And we're really hoping that it results in what many of the communities that I work in call a new New Deal for this country, a real poor people's movement. So hopefully through our efforts, through the efforts of our partners on the ground, through your support, we can make that a reality. Thank you.
So there you have our staff of 15 and four people. We're going to bring Paul up now to pull it all together for us.
Yeah, right. Wrap pull it all up together. And Laura, don't worry. Thank you very much. I don't think I've missed any of these. I had a brief absence during paternity leave, which my wife and I in our 40s said, really should we be doing this? But things happen. But I want to say, it's first of all, Anne, where's Anne? Thank you for having us back here. It feels like home to me. I get very nervous coming to New York, even getting on the subway. I think there's too many people. You know, how will I? I never saw a revolving door until I was 18. So thank you for having us here. When I got here, I met the great Blanche Cook. Where is Blanche? There you are. And Blanche said something that I think everyone who has heard these women speak tonight will agree. Nesri is you said the hope of our future. Did you not say that?
Hope of the future.
It's the hope of the future. To hear these presentations tonight, and I hope Laura will say something. Is that right?
Yes.
She doesn't trust me to make an ask, but I will.
Awesome.
I just feel so... Go ahead.
Introduce Phil, because he's the
I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm getting to Phil. But I just want to say, I agree with Blanche. I think that when we look at the problems that that face us now as a nation, as a planet, we have a group of people, however small it may be, who really can speak eloquently to the challenges that face us now. And I feel so lucky to have been part of this organization from the beginning. And just to go back a little bit to the beginning, I've been thinking hard about the question of rights for 25 years. Really hard. I mean, that may sound absurd, but it's true. I went to Haiti in 1983, and I went to rural Haiti, and I thought, how are we going to do anything meaningful? What is the model that would lead us forward? And, you know, there are many models to look at, to think about when we're talking about problems like people don't have enough to eat, they don't have a place to stay, they don't have health care. And the model that was most compelling to me was the rights model. That you have to have a rights model. But that was not the most compelling model in the world. There were public health models, public goods for public health. There were economic development models. Without basic health care, we're never going to develop. All those were helpful to me, but the rights model was the touchstone for me. And I just didn't know how to move it forward. You know, how could we talk in my country, the United States, about the right to health care? It seemed, or the right to housing, or the right to a job, or the, you know, on it goes, the right to education and not be expelled from school. And from the mid-80s until really quite recently, just maybe 2 or 3 years ago, or no, 4 or 5 years ago, I thought, well, we'll lift up as aspirational all efforts to promote social and economic rights, the right to health care, the right to housing, the right to a job. Imagine that as, you know, mainstream in our country. And then I met Kathy. And Kathy, I know you don't like it when I elevate an individual. She's always the movement person. Or as we say in post-feminist circles, the movement lady. And I've been looking around. I wrote something about 12 years ago, actually. My colleague will be my witness, about the need for the rights movement to think about social and economic rights. And I meant, again, the right to health care, the right to housing, the right to a job. And I didn't think this was going to be something that I'd run into in the United States, but I did. I got to meet Kathy, and she told me that she was going to start, along with friends, a veritable movement. She didn't say movement, but an organization to promote social and economic rights. And I said, sign me up. And I think that's what many of us, I'm looking at the board members here tonight, and looking at Blanche, who said, Nesri is the hope for the future. I think that's why we feel so enthusiastic about this effort. And that was before I met these incredible people. And that was before I heard Anya talk about healthcare, and Liz talk about education, and Tiffany talk about what we need to do in order to make housing something that is reasonable to aspire to shelter in a rainstorm. And I had been working, as I said, most of my life in Haiti. And recently, as many of you know, I was talking to one of my friends on the board here tonight about the very difficult times that the Haitians have faced just in the last few months. I mean, as if they hadn't faced difficult times in the last 204 years. But it's been very difficult in Haiti recently because four hurricanes struck Haiti in 1 month. And this will lead me back to this question of social and economic rights. In a month, massive amounts of infrastructure were wiped out. Schools, bridges, roads, healthcare infrastructure. But you know what really troubles me most of all is that Haiti is also the place where there are more NGOs than in any other country in the Caribbean. There are more private educational NGOs, there are more church-based groups, there are more health-related NGOs than any other country in the hemisphere, and yet Haiti is the weakest country in this part of the world, this half of the world, as far as healthcare, education, housing goes. And so as someone from the NGO movement, proudly enough, and I work for a small community-based college in Cambridge, Massachusetts as well, as someone from the university world, from the world of NGOs, and someone who works with church groups very often, I have to ask, this new humanitarian order that we hear about, is it not also a new humanitarian disaster for people living in poverty? And I've been asking this for 10 years, maybe 15 years, mostly to myself. But then I met Kathy and the band of, yes, they're women, okay, we'll get to Phil in a second. And the band of talented people who couldn't have done anything, all four of you. Laura, you'll hear from in a second. She doesn't think I'm going to make the ask properly, but I will, Laura. I will make you proud. I met these people and I said, this is the group that I'd like to cast my lot with. And I have been so grateful to work with them on thinking as an American about a sensible housing policy. How do we house the poor of our country? On thinking about how we could make health care available to 300 million people instead of however many million could pay for it. On thinking how we could even think about the rights of job security and well-being if it is reflected in the need for food. Again, something I see all the time in Africa and in Haiti. And I feel that I've finally found the group that I want to work with. And I agree with Blanche, Kathy. This, you know, Nesri is the hope for the future. And we want to be part of this movement. Now, and to make this movement work, this is, Laura, you may grade me starting now. Really, I was in a 4-hour meeting with them today. And when Kathy said that I should make the pitch, Laura looked really downcast. He won't do it, but I will. We are at a very remarkable crossroads, I think, in this country, and I doubt anyone here would disagree with me. I think we have a chance to, because of the financial crisis in this country, because of the problems that we've seen in recent years, we have two wars going on. I think this is a revelatory period. Our own work in Haiti, when four hurricanes struck, people have said to us, well, aren't you worried that you won't be able to do the work that you've been trying to do because of the stock market crash? And I have to say, I said, no, I'm not worried about that. I think that the kind of support that we've garnered over the years is really not tied to whether or not people are financially successful. It's more tied to what are your obligations, what kind of commitments do you have to good works? And, you know, I could be wrong. It may be that in a year from now, I'm unable even to get a shuttle down here because I have to hitchhike. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that our work, and I mean this very broadly, our work to promote basic rights for people living in poverty, as Tiffany just said so eloquently, thinking about housing, this could be a revelatory and promising moment for all of us who care about the right to survival, really. And in order to make that happen, we need to make Nesri strong. We need to find new supporters. Now, there is no Bill Gates for the social and economic rights movement. It's true. You know, I work in the global health movement, and we do have the Gates movement, not just Bill Gates, but Melinda Gates, Bill Gates Sr., and even Warren Buffett, who probably against his own best advice also contributed this. But there is not a group of billionaires fighting for social and economic rights. I mean, in a time when actually, I've been shocked by the debates when people said, oh, you know, these are vaguely socialist ideas. That's like the worst insult we could ever muster. I don't think we're going to have, in the next few years, a Bill Gates for Nesri. I don't. But we don't need a Bill Gates. I mean, I'd like a Bill Gates, and it's been great in global health to have someone of that stature, or really those resources, ponying up and saying, I'll go to bat for vaccines, for medications, for primary health care. That's been great. But it's not going to happen for social and economic rights. And so that's our job, that's my job, and that's everybody's job here. And how am I doing, Laura?
Great.
What, 8, 9, 4, what? That's our job here tonight, is that we have to go out there and find new people to bring on board. Because if we don't have a Bill Gates, we need 100, you know, Mimis, or 100 Blanches, or, you know, I was going to say 1,000 Kathys. Although she paid for my metro, what is it called here? Subway?
Metro card.
I got so nervous.
Metro card.
Getting on the, yeah, thank you, Kelly. Anyway, so we have to come together now and make sure that Nesri flourishes. We'll keep it alive, even without the help that is mustered here today. But to make Nesri flourish, we have to all go out and say, as some of us have been doing around electoral politics in the election, we have to find 5 people, 6 people, who will, you know, make some contribution to this movement. And I really believe in this more. I have spent my whole life focusing on Partners in Health. And it wasn't until, really, I heard about Nesri that I thought, I want to be part of this movement. And that's why I knew what Blanche was saying, that Nesri is going to be the future. We have to think about these basic rights. And the last point I'll make is that as someone who works predominantly in Haiti, in Africa, in Peru, even in Siberia, what we do here, you know, most of you are Americans, I am an American, and what we do here around these issues, especially the issues that you discussed, will determine the intellectual infrastructure of the human rights movement in Africa and Latin America, I'm sure of it. And I think well beyond Africa and Latin America. I think in Europe, in Asia. What we do here is going to determine the fates of so many people that, you know, again, I don't want to put too much pressure on Blanche, but I have to say, I agree. Nesri is the hope for the future, and that's why I'm on board. And I want all of us to go out and find resources for Nesri, and I would like a 10 out of 10 from Laura. So thank you very much, and I look forward to working with you all.
Laura will have the last word here, but I would
she
also
I was going to
introduce Phil, just so you know, we are making our greatest efforts to reach gender diversity, although it's not easy in this field. And I'll let Laura wrap it up and thank you. And I just want to thank everyone again. We're going to have a few minutes for questions and back and forth, but she's going to give you a few
comments. Paul did a great job, but I just have a few things to close up. I realize that most people in this room have probably felt the economic crisis that we're currently in some form or another, but there are those in this country that haven't felt it because their situation was already so burdensome and so dire, and they're fighting every day just to survive for their own well-being and their own livelihood. And as you heard from the program directors, that we work at a community level with groups to help them to help see these rights really recognized, because we want to see sustainable change happen in this country. So regardless of the outcome of our presidential election, we have a responsibility to continue the work that we've started, and it's with your help that we can build this movement even stronger. You all received a packet on your chair. If you didn't get one, we have a few in the back. So if you open it up, you have several Nesri publications inside, and then also a card that you can fill out if you're interested in donating this evening, or you can send it in at another time. But it's with your help, your ideas, and also telling others about the work that we're doing and encouraging them to get involved and learn more, that we can really make this movement sustainable and really see change happen in this country. I just want to take a moment to thank a few people. Thank Jeff again for his bringing the food and the drink and providing all the sustainable food that we have here tonight. So thank him. And also to Anne for hosting us in this lovely space, and we know that she really shares our vision and has been such a support to us. Also, of course, to Paul and our other board members who are here this evening, who have just been outstanding and such a resource for us. And then from all of us, we just want to thank all of you for coming to come and really share in this dialogue and in this new deal that we hope that we'll see will happen. So thank you all for coming.
Let's take two questions for Paul, and then he's got to go. You got an airplane to catch. You've forgotten about it, I can tell. Okay,
yeah,
you got to go.
Jeff? Sure. This is for Paul and Kathy. As I was speeding down the Merritt Parkway from Boston today, listening to Terry Gross on NPR, talking with Michael Pollan, who, if you're not familiar with Michael Pollan, he's in the slow food movement and he's a professor over at UC Berkeley. And he was talking about an open letter to the next administration mm-hmm. regarding food policy in the States, mm-hmm. which made me think about back in April. I was proud to help put together a conference on the Millennium Development Goals, and Paul, thanks a lot for coming out to speak. The students really appreciated that. And at the tail end of that conference, Jeff Sachs was there, and he also was mentioning this open letter that he was going to write to the next administration, outlining different points that his movement, specifically the UN Millennium Development Goals, and Michael Pollan with the U.S. agribusiness, or at least going against it. So it made me think, is there anything that NESRI or the U.S. human rights movement is going to be writing to this next president? And it seems, and the reason I ask that is because it seems like, I'm falling no pressure on this one, but if Jeff Sachs can stand in front of a lot of people and say that he's going to write this, and from whatever, from his popular book, it seems like you've been influencing him greatly, is it possible for someone from the U.S. human rights movement to write this letter?
There are two blueprints for the next administration that are coming out on human rights in the U.S. So one is the American Constitutional Society, and we're on the advisory board and have been helping develop that. And there's also a book, a small book by IPS that's being written, where Martha Davis, who's not here because she's doing a panel uptown, a chair of our board, myself, and a colleague of ours, Cindy Sue, who co-wrote a chapter on human rights blueprint for the next administration. Now, certainly, it's not a bad idea to turn some of that blueprint work into a shorter document, like an open letter, and get some of our luminaries, like Dr. Paul Farmer here, to sign on. But the sort of intellectual infrastructure has been developed in these blueprints. Do you want to comment on this?
Well, I would just say one thing, Jeff. First of all, when we look at the as a doctor, my job is to be interested in food security, because we see particularly children, but also adults sometimes, with malnutrition. And we know what to do. A child comes in with protein, calorie, and malnutrition. We know how to treat that. As I sometimes joke with my own students, you don't need a big NIH grant to decide that the treatment for malnutrition is something called food.
That's right.
And although we're browbeaten about this quite a bit. And the biggest, looking at this from the point of view of Haiti, I just actually wrote to Kathy about this yesterday, because the local production of rice in Haiti, for example, I was in Haiti in the 80s when, in 1 year, the rice farmers were just devastated because they had been pushed by the international financial institutions to, quote-unquote, open up their markets in return for credits or money, who knows what, the usual story.
Trade agreements,
absolutely. And as everyone in this room, I suspect, knows, we were encouraging poor countries to open up their markets, but in fact, we have a huge farm bill that makes it virtually impossible for example, Haitian farmers to compete with American farmers around rice, sugar, and the list goes on. And so I think that it's going to be very tough, because the politicians, including those who I plan to vote for shortly, still do not support equitable trade agreements. And I think, you know, like as Tequila just said, we need to decide once whomever is in place is in place, what would be the rights-based approach to this? How would we have a rights-based approach to food security, to not starving to death, to not being malnourished as a child or as an adult? It's going to be a very tough sell. And in order to have any tough sell, in other words, there are really, just like with the health insurance industry, there is a huge farm industry and shipping industry. You know, when people talk about the Iron Triangle, that I'm shocked to know that the third part of the triangle, the first part is, you know, the agricultural agribusiness, the second is shipping, that makes sense. But what is the third part of the triangle? It's the, you know, humanitarian NGO organizations that I'm, including groups like ours, although I hope we're not involved in this. In order to make this work, you have to have the collusion of people of goodwill. And I think we have to say, okay, is this what we want to do? Is this how we have a rights-based approach to food security and sustainable farming and the long list of things that are popular? But the really unpopular stance we'll have to take is going to be around the farm bill. And it's going to be very difficult. It's worth fighting, you know, as are all great rights struggles are worth fighting for. But it's going to be hard to do.
Another question for Paul before we send him off and doesn't miss his next presentation.
Well, I have a general question which he can address. Do you think that Obama, since he's like the person that nobody's really talking about but they're talking about, can't come out and say certain things because you have to win the election to get in the game? And if he comes out for some of these really progressive things that we all want to support, and we hope that he will want to support, if he comes out and verbalizes this right now, it's like the death knell, and it just gives ammunition to the other side.
I think that, I mean, let me back up with something somebody told me about the MST in Brazil. When Lula was elected president, they asked the landless peasant movement leaders, you know, and he was going slower than they wanted on land reform and all this stuff. They basically were pushing them to criticize Lula and say, you know, well, what do you think of this? And the leadership said, Lula's going to do what Lula's going to do, and our job is to make Lula do what we need to do. And so Obama, he's charting a course to victory. That's what he wants to do. And a lot of us, not necessarily in an organizational capacity, would like to see that happening. When Obama, I got an email from an activist in Chicago who told me that when he was running for the U.S. Senate, he was asked in a forum whether he supported the SCR covenant, the International Covenant on Economic Social Rights, and whether he thought housing was a human right. And in that forum, which that audience, he, you know, said yes. Now, will he say yes next year if he's president? That depends on what we do. We can't count on him to carry all the water. So, Paul?
But you know what? I would just have said I agree, and I was in Washington. I don't go to Washington that much, but I was on, as they say, on the Hill, and I went to visit a prominent supporter of Haiti, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. I won't mention her by name, but her name reminds me of carrying the water. and you know, we were sitting around, and it was just she and I and one other colleague from Partners in Health, a nurse, and she was talking about, since I'm not, haven't mentioned who it is, I can quote her, and she was talking about Obama, and I assumed, of course, as an American citizen who's not involved in politics, that she would know all about him, and they'd know each other, and they're both members of Congress, after all, and they grand sense. And she said, don't you think he could just give us a little whisper in our ears of what he plans to do? And I just understood something, back to Tequila's question. It can't be easy to do what he's trying to do, or anyone else is trying to do, to be a mainstream political figure. Mm-hmm. Now, does he have progressive views? I don't know. I mean, I'm not his biographer, and I'm not from Illinois. But I have friends who, you know, who are, like Jan Schakowsky, some of you know, is a congresswoman from that area who's the co chair of his. She's a true progressive. She, you know, these the rights that our three program people talked about tonight, she supports all of them. And she says, yes, yes, you know, and it doesn't matter, because the real point is we have to carry the water. We have to, regardless of what kind of person he happens to be or what kind of administration we get next time, and I certainly hope it is he, we still have our work to do. On housing, on health care, on jobs, on dignity, this is our job, you know, and that's why, to me, Nesri, the hope of the future, as Blanche said, but also, I, as an American, I finally feel that I have an organization that I can, you know, really push forward as a way for us to, you know, have real national dignity as a people. And I don't want to put too much shine too grand a light on Nesri, but Nesri's small. There's like two people who work there. I'm kidding. Exactly. By the way, Partners in Health has 6,000 employees, so, you know. It's a small organization, but it's big in every other sense. It's big in every other sense. And we need to carry the water. And Nesri can't do that with 6 employees, but what Nesri can do as a movement is to say, this is not about a small number of staffers. I actually don't work for Partners in Health. I never have. I've always been a volunteer. This model of us being the community, us being the real Nesri, and helping this small group of people, including Phil, the only guy, to move this, carry this water, that's our job. And I think, you know, whatever happens in 2 weeks, we have to be ready as the American human rights movement that is focusing on these really key issues.
One last question.
Yeah.
Now, before we take a quick break, I'd just like to piggyback on that in terms of, because of the person here and everything everybody's been saying, I'm committed and hopeful that Obama is trying to get elected. And then our work really starts on November 5th. Our work first is, I mean, it's every day, but first to vote for him, get him in, and then I agree with you. So is there some plan in terms of how do you contact, you know, group members? How do you then, like, build this, you know, way of us petitioning and making, you know, apparent to the government and to, you know, Obama and whomever that these are the agendas, and, you know, we all have that fear that this could go the Clinton way, that, you know, little by little, every group that supports someone getting into office gets, you know.
From those in the know, there's apparently, Alec, take him to a plane now. Those in the know, you're going.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, it's just to do more speaking about rights, so forgive me for sneaking in.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Thank you,
Paul.
Thank you. Laura, thank you.
From people who are in the know, there's two interventions that are the most actually effective, and it's not maybe the most obvious. But apparently appointments, who gets appointments, who gets appointed sets the tone. So a lot of people spend a lot of time focusing on the transition team, on waste of time. Where you want to really influence is appointments. So if you know people who you think candidates you want to back, you know, try to influence, figure out who's making those appointments. There's a smaller sub-team that makes appointments, that's who you really want to get to. And that's what some of the people working on the blueprints for human rights are trying to figure that out. And we have a pretty big group of about 18 or 19 people who are going to be using all their contacts figuring this out. And the other is the State of the Union. What gets said, even one line or two, becomes, in a sense, the strategic plan for all the agencies for the rest of the year. And that's, and there's a window of opportunity there because it happens really fast. So those are the two. You know, whoever has pull, those are the two places to, yeah.
I'm curious, and I don't know if you all came into this, since we're on this conversation, which is the degree to which the non-movement that is so mobilized around Obama, it could, if he wins, go to sleep, or could continue to be the powerhouse of the future. To what degree do you see that in the variety of work that you're doing, and you know, because with all of these issues, the question is the degree to which we've got. You know, I agree with Paul. I think that the disaster, the economic disaster, is an advantage, you know, for us in terms of moving social and economic rights forward. But I'm really wondering where the young are.
Well, I mean, it's you see huge generational differences. Right, you started the conversation in a very different place. For one thing, you don't have to have a conversation about being globalized with people under a certain age. They're like, well, what else is there? Right, they grew up in a globalized world. Second, they don't carry a lot of baggage around economic and social rights. It's much more instinctual for them. So you have a much greater level of receptivity. And you do have, although it's maybe not as obvious or as visible as it may have been in other decades, you do have growing student activity quite a lot. So the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has a sort of parallel organization called the Student Farm Worker Alliance. And they can turn any city on a dime because that network is so vast. And that's probably one of the most organized student movements I know about. Phil can talk. Why don't you talk a little bit about Philly and the youth there? These are working class youth, not university youth like the SFA.
Sure. Well, I just moved here from Philadelphia. And in Philly, one of the groups I worked with is called the Philadelphia Student Union. And they're a group of high school students that have chapters in schools across the city. And they're just a phenomenal group that are organizing around issues in their own schools, around the books they have access to or the dignity, the way they're treated and the teacher quality and that kind of stuff. But they've also recently started going out and joining with taxi drivers who are organizing in the taxi industry or folks fighting gentrification or aligning with immigrants who are dealing with different situations. And so it's an amazing thing to see that happening and to see that synergy of them hooking up with other sectors and of a broader movement.
So it's not just college youth. A lot of the youth that have organized, that Liz works with, that have organized out of the abuses in the schools, which include the group that Phil just had a very strong relationship with, that's growing and connecting, and you see real potential there. It's still localized. What's missing is creating the tissue that links them.
And can I just add to a bit, in terms of the work that I've been doing around housing, and in particular around post-Katrina work, you know, when Katrina first happened, you had a lot of different communities that wanted to help with recovery, but after a while, a lot of those communities and individuals left for a variety of reasons. But what I found is that the population that has stayed and remained has been students, young people. I mean, they continue to be engaged with post-Katrina issues, recovery around public housing. They're very engaged around that as well. And in fact, Brenda Stokely, who's over there, she's the founder of New York Solidarity Coalition for Katrina and Rita Survivors. And Joetta is actually a survivor from Alabama, and who has been displaced to New York. And they work an awful lot with Sarah Lawrence College and the students there. So as Kathy was saying, what I found in my work is that one of the communities that I've been able to rely on has been the student group, student organization, and the student movement. And I just wanted to sort of just back up a bit about a question someone had about how do you get this agenda on the next administration sort of table. And one thing that we've been trying to do around getting the congressional hearings is to get more media and publicity around the crisis facing poor Americans and their housing options. And so if any of you work in media, have media contacts, please, you know, see me, let's talk, let's dialogue. We have been able to get some good pieces. In fact, Grit TV had a whole discussion around the anniversary of Katrina back in August where they talked about public housing, and Dr. Novell was on that segment, as well as Sam Jackson, who's one of our partners in New Orleans. And then not long after that, a newspaper in Minneapolis had a whole article on the need for congressional hearings. So we also think that the more that we can get some kind of press, the more that can start the dialogue that will hopefully, you know, reach up to, if not a national level, enough people that we can begin to, as we've been talking about, build this movement. So again, please talk to me if you do have media contacts or you work in media.
So you all have been extremely patient and listened to a lot of talking, so I'm going to let you drink. And I'm going to let you eat and continue talking to each other.
More tomorrow.